So I'd like to sort of start by finishing the story of Snowy River. I'm still here, so ultimately the story has a more or less interesting ending, but not an ending ending. So what happened actually is that I got aboard this poor animal, and it could sense that I really didn't know what I was doing.
No. This animal stood 6 feet at the shoulder, 5 feet, 6 inches at the shoulder.
And so what happened is that it reared, and that I came down and I rolled right between its legs as it came down. Now what's interesting is that it didn't touch me. So clearly, it was much more than I could handle, and so we sent it back. But we didn't stop. I'd ridden before a bit, and so we didn't stop, and then I got another horse. But there are three things that Snowy River taught me. First is that if I'm frightened, it's going to be frightened. So the thing that occurred was not aggression, it was fear. There was no intent to harm me. He could have trampled me to death, to be quite honest. But the hooves came down on either side of me. They didn't touch me.
He was actually quite a carefully thinking, mean horse. For good reason, he had been abused, but it was just, you could just see the intent in his eyes, and he would say, "You just escaped this."
And so we connected with his history and his fear. So one of the things I learned is that aggression is not always aggression. Aggression is often a result of embedded fear that I just triggered. It wasn't personal. It was terrifying, but not personal. And the other thing that it taught me is that I needed to know my own limits. And it was a relatively harsh lesson, but I think I learned it relatively well. I needed to know my own limits. And so when I'm engaging with something, and when I'm engaging with my own practice, I also need to know that I have to engage with my limits in my practice. Because if I become too arrogant about my mindfulness, for instance, I sometimes find myself in situations that scare me, and that I scare who else is there? And the response is almost always not positive. And so it became a lesson and a metaphor for how to approach mindfulness. And we got another horse, Harry Appleseed, nicer name.
Johnny's brother.
Johnny's brother. Also, I'm a fairly large person, also a fairly large horse, and with its own quirks, and he and I party company a few times, but not quite so drastically. And so each case, what I found is that when I'm dealing with somebody who intends for me to be able to know what I'm doing, and they discover that I don't, sometimes they take advantage, but almost always that's not maliciously intended, it's motivated by fear. And so when I'm really trying to actually apply my mindfulness practice, when I'm really trying to connect with where I am, I always have to be very humble about my ability to sustain my own emotional state in the presence of something that I may find intimidating, terrifying, or upsetting. So progressed to Harry, and he and I did a bunch of different things. As I say, parted company a couple of times because I asked him to do things that I wasn't prepared to do. And always remember that. I asked him to do things I wasn't prepared to do, and he knew it. And so it really is a mindfulness wake-up call. Because when I want him to do something that I'm not sure I want to do, he picks it up, and he picked it up, and he said, we're not doing this. Because if it's scaring you, what do you think I'm feeling? Okay? And so his job was to teach me my practice. So long as I allowed myself to have the humbleness to say, this is the level of my practice, and I engage with that in a particular way, things went smoothly. Harry was a wonderful ride. Periodically decided he didn't want me on his back because he wanted to go home, but I could always pick that up and say, I think I'll stay, most times. But that was a kindness. He was just a little tired, and he felt that I should walk. And so with that process of just really coming into your practice, with a sense of humbleness, what happens is you begin to connect with things in a manageable pace. And so, what I could have done after Snowy River, and fortunately I'm a touch stubborn, what I could have done after Snowy River is to give up entirely upon something that became a beautiful, beautiful sport. To say that I was incompetent. I always do things that I really can't do. What makes me think I can? And I have a history, and childhood history, of not being particularly good at things athletic. And so I go back to that old, old story about who I was, and I translate that into who I am. And so mindfulness is also about knowing that story is just a story. It may not necessarily be true, and often isn't. So being able to connect with the felt experience of feeling myself progress helps me take the story aside and put it in its place. Because no matter what my story says, I became more and more proficient. So sometimes we hear the stories, and we say to ourselves, let's run the experiment. And sometimes the experiment says the story's not all that great. And so at the end, about the time a bunch of things happened and I quit writing, we were given what was really a huge animal that had actually gone lame, but became sound again because we put some shoes on it that allowed some things to heal in the hoof. And so I had what was to have been a championship horse, which was way over my ability. And then what I got was a guide. And this is a fellow who used to be one of the directors of the musical ride for the RCMP. So you may or may not know this, but the RCMP people who ride horses arrive in Ottawa never having ridden a horse in their life. And so in close to 18 months, they have him going across the world. So he knows what he's doing. And what he said was, because I get on this horse, and I've ridden well enough and all. So when this horse spooked, when it started, it was like an elevator. He went straight down, and it was a long way down, and straight back up. And when he really spooked, he went sideways several feet. And so what he said to me was this: you don't have to do anything big. It's the smallest possible touch that lets the horse know what you want. It's your setting deep in the saddle when it does that, as opposed to coming out of it in fear, that lets it feel confident and not be scared. Because horses are prey. They're fear-driven. All of them. And you just need to move just this much. Pay attention. Mindfulness is a bit like that. Just pay attention to the breath. Notice its difference. So the whole process was really mindfulness training in a very different way. It was knowing exactly what I needed to do so that I could be in the space where I could let the horse know it was okay for us to be doing this. So the horse felt safe with me, not me safe with it. That wasn't the deal. It had to feel safe with me. So all of that was a lesson that I learned more or less well. Sometimes I didn't. And I'm always prepared to say that wasn't all that skillful. But sometimes it all came together and I said, ah, that was beautiful. And so for a period of time, and until the horse had a heart murmur as well, until Galaxy was his name, until Galaxy passed away, we'd gallop across fields, we'd do all kinds of interesting things, and we'd have fun. And it was my beginning to say, this is where I am, honoring that, and just allowing my practice, and that's what it was practice, allowing my practice and my confidence build in my practice so I could step into places that before I'd never dreamed of. So those of you who have a practice already know this, don't you? Is that it's the ability to sit quietly with yourself and have this really disciplined conversation about what's going on here. We always blame the horse because we've scared him or her. We've scared it. Okay? We always blame the horse because it didn't do what we wanted it to do. We blame the horse because when I fall off, when the horse is typically responding to me and says, if this is crazy for you, it's crazy for me. And that's what happens. It was crazy for me, and he said, no way I'm doing it. So it's that ability to be present for ourselves in an honest way that lets us to be present for others. Because all beings, they respond to my quietness with quiet. They respond to my agitation with agitation. They respond to my aggression when I'm scared, because often that's where it comes from, with aggression. And so it doesn't mean those things aren't going to happen, but we have to take ownership of what caused it to happen. It doesn't mean we stop our practice or give up on it. It means that, oh, practice didn't fail. I failed my practice. I asked of it more than it was able to do. And then I come back again. None of this is logical. None of this makes any sense cognitively. It's all felt. That's why we started in the body. Frank, his name is Frank as well, the guy who was the riding master, didn't say, here's where you want to put your foot, Frank. He said, with his hand, put it there, feel where it is. Connect to that. Know what the experience of having your foot there is. Now move it just a quarter of an inch. That's too far. Move it just a quarter of an inch. What happens? Set deep in confidence in the saddle, horse settles down. Come out of it just a bit, it says, what's going on here? Okay. So our bodies do that. Our bodies translate their mindfulness into the way it responds to what's in front of us. So that's why we start with the body. And that's why we always end with the body. It's where the learning is. And so this is your first taste of what wisdom is. Wisdom is not about knowing. Wisdom is about knowing. It's a about being an embodied experience, that when I put my foot where I put my foot, I know that I've connected where it should connect. So we always come back to the body as the beginning. And from that becomes my ethical response. I care about this animal that's caring about me. It's my job to have that animal comfortable and safe in my presence, and I will do the best I can. Unlike people, the horse is pretty primitive, so it's going to tell me when it's not comfortable in my presence, and I have to correct that. People often just don't do anything. So we have to be extra careful when we're engaging, when we're trying to share our wisdom, that what we do is we listen to our own response to what we're doing, because that's our best gauge. And when we're tentative, it's tentative. So much of what we do will be an explanation of what you have to experience. Much of what we talk about is related to the wisdom that's embodied in every mindful movement, every breath, every time I sit with myself and bring my attention back to the breath, every time I connect with an object and feel that object in my hand, every time I go out and sense and savor, bringing into me the things that are really, really powerful in the world out there that enable me to recharge, to regenerate. It's a felt experience. We don't have to save the world. Many of us are obviously worried, and we all are, about the state of the world. It doesn't matter what your persuasion is, we're all concerned. What we're looking at is not that big picture, because we really have little control over that. What we're looking at is our next engagement with the next person in front of us that we want to connect to compassionately. Do we connect with that person from our own confidence and our own ability to connect with ourselves compassionately in the presence of that person? Do you know how to set the limits so that we can continue to be compassionate? Do we also, not that we want something from this, but we've approached this from generosity because we are feeling able to be generous, enabled to be generous. We know that intuitively it's a felt experience. Do we hear the yes, you should? With a bit of pit in your stomach? Or do we hear it with a sense of butterflies saying that sounds interesting? And how do we respond to that? What do we consume? And what do we say to ourselves when inevitably we falter, fall off the horse, and thank goodness the horse just stamps around us, doesn't stop us? Do we say, I'm no good at this, I can't do it, I have to stop? Or do we say, maybe I should step back a bit and go within my limits? It doesn't hurt that my four-year-old daughter at the time won her first ribbon on this horse, so we had to be okay. Harry Appleseed. And so that's the essence of mindfulness. We connect with it. We let it down, therefore it lets us down. We take a deep breath. We reconnect to it. We carry it for a while. It carries us for a while. And then inevitably, it lets us down again. And then we take a breath, step back, start where we need to, and continue again. Never, ever is it smooth. Always is it keep our company at times, and I learn from the experience.
Full disclosure, in all that fit of coughing, I've completely forgotten what I was going to talk about. So, let's just start with a poem. And some of you may already know this by Mary Oliver, Wild Geese. I think it's the quintessential poem that expresses the heart of self-compassion and all the pieces that go into being self-compassionate, into the practice of self-compassion. And we'll be exploring that all day tomorrow. I think this is a good start. You do not have to be good. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.
We've covered a lot of material in the last 2 months or so that we've been here. I was calculating outside, what would it cost to run a 1 month retreat? The eyes light up. No. No. We definitely have to have fish and chips at least once in that month. It's amazing what we can dive into when we're not distracted. You know, amazing what depths we can go to when there isn't that push and pull. And I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed with the solidity of your practice, with the stillness, the quietness that you've dropped into very quickly, far quicker than many groups we've run, many retreats we've led. But we do say that at every retreat. I don't want you to get too excited about how great this is going. But I'm sure it hasn't been, you know, all smooth and quiet and lovey-dovey inside. I'm sure it's been a struggle at times. And that's okay. That's what it's supposed to be.
We're supposed to find that edge where we're growing, right? Because you only grow at the edge. And I think the theme that keeps coming back for me, you know, we talk about the body, we talk about emotions, we talk about all these conceptual things about sensations and what they are and all that, which is important in terms of practice. Without naming it, we talked about that cognitive frontal lobe thinking executive function thing today. But underneath all of that is something far deeper. It's the why of all of it. Why are we doing this? What's compelled us to give up the comforts of home, the, you know, the connection with people, and to self-isolate? The one thing we're so afraid of, which is being isolated by others, we're choosing to do voluntarily and paying money to self-isolate, right? When you look at it that way, it makes absolutely no sense. So clearly there's something really important in all of this for us to get together like this. And a year after year, our weekend retreat has always, you know, been packed with people, and year after year, the same people come. And, you know, to the point where we wonder, you know, we're going to have room for more new people who want to come, and there always is. We always create the space. And it's like a gathering every year. And I keep asking myself, but didn't you learn everything you needed to last year? Well, maybe we're just not very good teachers, and they keep having to come back to figure it out again. You know? But they come back, and we come back, and we learn, and we grow. And in the end, I think, and I can be completely off, you know, wrong on this one, as I am on many things, it's that desire to feel confirmed that we belong. Somewhere in this crazy, tumultuous, oftentimes painful and confusing world, once a year I know where I belong. Once a year, I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to apologize for who I am. I just show up. And I think that informs me about what we've been doing this week. In all the 5 days that we've run, whether they were self-compassion 5 days where you get to talk, or silent 5 days where you don't, I don't think it matters. It's, you know, the motivation, the intention is different, but ultimately I don't think the final product is different. I hope, and I think I believe, that we're offering ourselves an opportunity to confirm that we have the right to be here, wherever here is. At this moment, it happens to be on your 4x4 mat or 2x2 mat. You know, life can completely unfold on a 2.5 foot by 2.5 foot square mat, as you've learned over the 5 days. No, not quite 5 days yet, still only four. And I think that's the essence of why I practice. I practice because in every moment, I feel that pull away from that sense of belongingness. And I need to reground, I need to regroup. There's a wonderful story in Buddhist mythology that was life-changing for me when I really studied it closely. I've always been a big lover of mythologies and stories and historic stories, and love the fact that now, you know, the female aspects and the female contributors to these stories are coming forward. The mythological females are showing up more and more. And I don't just mean Wonder Woman, although she's pretty cool.
But in Zen tradition, is a tradition I practice, and you know, the when we take our vows, when we take jukai, which is an admission into a particular lineage, you have to draw your lineage. So you start with a little circle at the top, and it says Shakyamuni Buddha, male, right? And then it goes down and winds down, and you have to draw this winding line without any mistakes. And you're doing it on rice paper, and of course if you make a mistake, like a splotch or something, you've got to start all over again. I was sneaky. I drew little pencil lines. And then I gave it enough waviness in the pen to look like I actually wasn't really using a ruler. It's very, really awful to start out your vows by lying. That's me. I can be very competitive. Sometimes. All the time. So this lineage is this long, windy thing that you draw, and then you write in the names of all the Zen masters, even the fake ones, right? Even though we know that they're fake, we're supposed to put them in there. And we write them in, over 100 of them. And then we come down to our teacher, right? And her teacher, and her teacher's teacher. And you don't get to put little sidebar things like this guy was a drunk, this guy was a womanizer. You don't get to do that, right? You do this as a sacred document. And my teacher is the only female in that entire lineage from Shakyamuni Buddha from, you know, 523 BC all the way to now. So you can rest assured that's a fake lineage. Because the history books are full, the scriptures are full of Zen women who've beaten the butt off these Zen masters in all of the Zen debates. Right? But we don't know who they are. So much of the Zen tradition is now about who are we as, you know, the feminine energy in this, the female archetype, the whatever you want to call it, the alternate to these Zen masters who were basically drunkards, womanizers, and you know, seed spreaders all across Asia, right? I mean, who are we? Who the heck are we? And so somewhere along the line, Grace Shearson, this is not at all what I was originally going to talk about. Grace Shearson wrote this book called Zen Women. And she drew the Zen hierarchy, right? Again, and it was circular. It was this circle, and it overlapped, because teachings overlapped. They're not unilateral things that happen at points. They grow. One teacher passes it on to a student. The student passes it on. And the whole Zen lineage is full of secret passings-ons of teachings and people running away in the middle of the night with the bowl and the robe, and really sneaky, nasty bunch of guys that started this whole thing, right? And the Zen women who have been traced through the literature as having existed were basically tea sellers and flower garland weavers and housekeepers. And they'd sit by the roadside, and some Roshi or the other would come along, a Zen teacher would come along, a realized Zen teacher would come along, and they'd ask, they have these little Zen battles of, you know, nonsensical koans and stuff. And she'd typically win, because there's always, you know, the ending of the story is always capitalized by, she took her water jug and smacked him. And I think that's where our practice has to come to when we're challenged by things. We're challenged by whatever it is we're being faced with, is to pick up that water jug and smack them. Because that's the final answer. The final answer is no, you're not doing this anymore. Right? I don't smack Frank with the water. I just buy him horses.
So far, I've survived.
So it's really interesting that this whole concept of belongingness that we cultivate through these retreats is an ongoing thread in the tapestry of who we are in any community that gathers. Right. And what's really, really powerful
And I think we've missed it in Zen teachings, and we don't hear enough about it in Buddhist teachings, is a story about how the Buddha became enlightened. Now remember, all of these stories, you know, have him BC something or the other, who the heck knows what really happened, but it's a great teaching story. Right? So the Buddha kind of goes through all of his life history and his asceticism and this and that and the other, and decides he's going to conquer his inner demons. He's going to sit. Kind of like most of us come to retreat, you know, I want to conquer my inner demons, so I sit. And as the story goes, inner external demon Mara shows up in all faith traditions, right? Mara shows up in different names and guises. But Mara is our dark side. And Mara says, ugh, you're wasting your time. Seriously, you really think sitting on your butt under a tree is going to do anything for you? And the Buddha sits. And so Mara goes, ugh, I'm going to distract you. So remember I talked about the three ways we have of avoiding experience, rejection, clinging, and confusion. And another way of saying it is anger, lust, and self-delusion. So Mara sends a herd of flock of arrows. And so this is the anger, right? We pierce someone else with arrows. And the Buddha kind of, his power in meditating is so great, it turns the arrows into flowers, and the flowers fall. It's lovely. He goes, okay, that didn't work. So he sends his three daughters, and they try to seduce him. And that doesn't work. The daughter's going to dissolve into dust. And now Mara's really pissed because they go his primary means of you know, ruining the human race, which is through desire and lust and greed and craving, right? So he goes, okay, fine. Got to pull out the big guns here. The most powerful thing that can undermine us is doubt. Doubt about everything. What should I wear? How do I make this decision? Who do I listen to? What do I listen to? What do I choose? Should I go to this retreat? Should I not? Should I take this job? Should I not? Am I good enough? Am I not good enough? Why am I good enough? Am I really good enough? Who do I talk to about being good enough? Doubt is the one thing that erodes all of our foundations. It's toxic, and it corrodes, slowly corrodes away everything. And so that was what the Buddha did, what Mara did. He basically became the Buddha's internal voice and said, and some people say it was already an internal process, and he said, are you sure you can do this? I've been sitting here a long time, you know, and nothing's happened. Isn't it getting boring? I mean, sit, stand, walk, sit, stand, walk. Isn't it getting boring? I'll bet you're hungry. I wonder what they're having for lunch. Wouldn't you rather be having lunch than actually doing this? I don't know if that's what he says, but that's what he says to me in my head when I'm sitting. Right? You know, you've been at this for 40 years, you're still not enlightened. And of course the Buddha starts to shake at the time, Shakyamuni starts to shake, and he starts to think, okay, because some of this is true. That's why doubt can be so eroding. A tiny piece of it is true. I am not as good as I would like to be for this job that I'm applying. I am not as good a person as I would like to be, nowhere close. It's true, but it magnifies. It magnifies. It's like Mara's got Photoshop, and he takes that one blemish, he blows it up and highlights it and gives it different colors and goes, see? Not so great, are you? So fascinatingly, and this is the powerful part, whatever else we may believe about all the mythology around it, Shakyamuni says, I have the right to be here. Regardless of what the outcome is, regardless of all of my efforts, regardless of anything that I do with my life, I have the right to choose to be here. And so he engages in the mudra that we call touching the earth. He puts his, and you will see sometimes on little statues of Buddha, he's got his hands down like this with the fingers down, and they're touching the ground. Right? And that was his statement. His statement at that point was, I may be imperfect. I may be completely out in left field on this thing. I may have screwed up my entire life. I may have done terrible things. But I have the right to be here and learn how to investigate my mind. I have the right to be here and be who I am in this moment. And of course, according to the mythology, you know, the earth rose up and confirmed his right to be there. And I think that's beautiful. And for me, I remember going through a period like that when the only option I had was to touch the earth, truly and physically touch the earth and say, I have the right to be here. You cannot cast me out. You can cast me out on all the other, you know, official things and the structural stuff, but you cannot take my practice away from me. And I do believe that that is what we're called to do when we come to a retreat. We are in many different ways asking for admittance into a realm we are already living in, we are already embodying, we already own. So there's no permission that can be given. But we have to assert the right to be here, wherever Hugh may be. We have to assert that right that says, no matter what, no matter what anyone thinks of me, defines me as, decides to make of me, decides to push me towards, I have the right to be where I am. So we can talk about the body, we can talk about emotions, we can talk about sensations, we can talk about thinking, we can talk about the five skillful habits. In the end, where it starts is our assertion, our owning this 2.5 square foot that we put our butt on. Until we own that, everything else is mechanistic. Everything else is a hope for something different, which is okay. But belonging is probably the most powerful experience we can have. And not belonging can be the most painful, is the most painful. And it doesn't have to be this big dramatic thing. You know, in little ways, we experience that not belonging. In little ways, we feel that doubt eroding away our belief that we do belong, we have the right to be here. We don't even notice it. You know, we don't even notice it. And then all of a sudden, one day, it's like, wait, what? What am I doing here? Who am I? All these parts of myself that I don't own anymore, I don't even know anymore because they've been eroded. My connection with them has been eroded away. So the whole motivation, I hope for, I know for me and I hope for you, is to find out where you belong. And hold fast to where that is. It may disappoint a lot of people. It may really piss off a lot of people too. It may bring out, as Frank said, you know, it may bring out their aggression because it's a little frightening to assert our right to be where we are. It brings out their aggression because they're afraid. If you think you belong there, well, what does that say about me? Where do I belong? Because I define myself by you being here. In any relationship, right? It's always about how do we organize our orbits so that we don't suck each other in and destroy each other. So the clarity we get when we sit, the clarity that we get when we connect with who we are completely within our body and our
entire experiencing system. Is that opening, the end point of that is, this is where I belong. It's not about the four, you know, higher levels of consciousness, which if you get there is fantastic, it's a really cool place to be apparently. If you levitate, you know, it's a great way to live. Sometimes it's clean energy, you know. I just can't think of the places we can go if we could levitate. We just don't meditate enough. Let's get down to this and get it done. It doesn't matter. What matters, I believe, and I'm, you know, leave it to you to find out if it's real for you or not, I believe, is that we never forget that right where we are is where we belong. Because then it doesn't matter. The world can change around us. It can be tumultuous. It can be, you know, horrific. It can be difficult. But we are solid in the ground we stand on. I decided at some point I wanted to run a marathon. I'm still trying to figure out if I'll ever run a marathon, but probably not at this age and with my wonky knees. It was so hard just to run a 5K. It was excruciatingly painful. When it worked, it was great. And then as I got older, it seemed to just get harder and harder. And also a lot of, because my psychology around it was terrible. I was struggling up a hill one day. You shouldn't make hills on slopes, you know? A stupid place to put a hill on a slope, really. Because, you know, your feet go up like this and the ankles bend and your knees are out of whack and it hurts your back. And why can't they just put hills on flat land? And I'm listening to this crazy talk in my head and laughing at myself going, yeah, there you go. You're maybe you need some water. Maybe you're dehydrated. But I was only out of the house for like 2 minutes and there's a hill right in front of the house. I was already defeated. And it suddenly hit me. You probably already know this, which is why you're so brilliant. No matter where your feet are, it's always flat. Right? Because here's the ground, here's your foot. Here's the ground, here's your foot. Your foot's flat, the ground is flat. Right there in those 7 inches, the ground is always flat. I got through every hill after that. I know it makes no sense to you, but it makes absolute sense to me. But I got through every hill after that because the ground under my foot is always in contact with the complete foot, which means, ego, in my crazy mind, it is flat. Doesn't matter whether it makes sense. It got me through hills, right? And in a sense, I think that's how I approach all of my challenges, is that where you're standing is just fine. It's compensating for whatever it is you're standing on. Whether it's an 11 degree grade or whether it's a 0 degree grade, is compensating for that. Right. And as long as we can ground ourselves, embody ourselves solidly on our feet, which is why mountain pose is so important, standing meditation is so important, balanced movements like Tai Chi, mindful movements, all of that are so, so important. Because we can't talk ourselves into being balanced. We have to experience being off balance and then coming back into balance. And that's where we belong. No one can take that away from us. And in a sense, that is the earth rising to confirm our belongingness right there. So don't settle. I'm really upping the game here. Don't settle, you know, for that blissful feeling or the fourth jhana or whatever magical thing that, you know, we offer in terms of higher level meditations. The practice of asserting your belongingness anywhere you stand is a lifetime practice because it will be challenged over and over and over. And it's that core steadiness that allows you to assert that you belong.
forget everything else we may have talked about, but don't forget that. All of this is only in the service of learning that we belong, and no one can take that away from us. It was true in 400 and 523 BC, and it's true today. I've run out of stories, but there was a story I wanted to tell about the horses. I'm always concerned because I know how abusive the competitive circuits are in equestrian fields. And we ended up unintentionally being a rescue center for horses that were unmanageable everywhere else. Not quite sure why, but maybe because we were unmanageable too. But we were blessed with some amazing animals that had gone through really rough times. The first pony we went to buy was $500, and he was in a farm out in
Alexandria.
And the father wanted to sell him because his name was Hawkeye. He was the stubbornest beast ever. And the father wanted to sell him because he spooked easily. And so Frank went to, well, we went to check out the horse. And I said, well, what does he spook at? He goes, well, my daughter was riding him, and I was shooting pigeons in the barn with a shotgun, and the horse ran away. I thought, you effing so-and-so. Okay, so well, we're buying him. I don't care. I don't care what we do with him. We knew nothing about horses except that we'd been dragged by a couple.
I was dragged by one.
You were dragged by one. I fell off. I fell off gracefully. You got dragged. You probably wouldn't have gotten dragged if I hadn't been screaming. But, you know. Well, it's the construction boots and the stirrups, too. You never wear construction boots when you're riding. But anyway, we brought Hawkeye home. It was a thunderstormy night, and our neighbor who had this animal transport pickup truck, they went out to pick up this horse several hundred kilometers away in a pickup truck with wooden boards on the side in a thunderstorm. It's an exciting life out on the farm. Or it was. So he came home, and he was just the sweetest, stubbornest, nicest, cuddliest animal I've ever had other than my dogs. And then it grew from there, because then we had another one that, yeah, you know, can't be ridden anymore. And do you want to just put him out to pasture? So sure, why not? Then came Sam, came Samoa Pizarro came, and Samoa was a calculating little witch. She would wait for you and then back you into the barbed wire. She had fun. She thought that was funny. She would stand there and laugh at you. But I thought, okay, fine, that's your gig, fine. We'll go with it. We couldn't ride her, so we bred her, and so we got Star, who we may be losing in the next few months, which is very sad, because we were there at her birth. And then we got Harry Appleseed, and then we got Gal. And suddenly, in a couple of years, they all died. And Star was left, and she was distraught beyond belief, because she'd been in a herd of five horses, right? And suddenly she was alone, and she'd never been without these other galoots. And so she wandered off with our daughter to other farms where she had buddies and stuff. And now she's around the corner. And but they've taught us so much. They've taught us, and I think if we summarize it in riding terms, and we had the kindest, gentlest coaches and trainers. You know, the horses were never beaten, they were never brutalized in any way. It was always a partnership and never put into any situation that was dangerous for them. They loved going out and competing. They loved going out on long rides with other horses. And that was how our time was spent, just kind of trail riding through. We have a huge forest area in the area. So just it was great. It was a great community. Yeah. And now, then we became an inadvertent rescue center for dogs. And the occasional cat. Bunny. Yeah. The bunny you forgot to bury. So I think our life has been full. It's been full with many, what we call many bodhisattvas, many little saints that have come along and taught us patience and kindness and compassion and intense worry when they're sick and gigantic vet bills. Worth every penny. Worth every penny. So we learn the entire earth rises and confirms our right to be here. Just as every one of those, a half wolf, a half coyote. We rescued him from the basement of a house townhouse in Ottawa. The wife of the man who owned the dog was so terrified of this half coyote that she made him keep the dog in the basement. And the dog wouldn't stay down there, so he tied the dog to a 100-pound weight, which it dragged back and forth every night. So this dog had muscles like you wouldn't believe, right? So we got him for $50, brought him home, most amazing animal ever. He used to come home with gophers that he'd brought home for dinner, and I would get mad at him, and he'd get really upset and hurt and wounded, and he'd go off for 3 days. And fine, I brought dinner, you don't want it.
My daughter had her own coyote, met her at the bus stop when she got off, and came back with her.
So when we look around, we're blessed. We're blessed by all these supportive creatures, two-legged and otherwise. Budgies. Don't forget the budgies, although I don't quite count them. Too small to eat. They were cute.
It was great.
So we have all these creatures, these presences around us that, you know, remind us that we're one of a very large web and we belong. There is a node in that web that is you. Not yours, you. And in that node, everything else exists. And that's why we practice. At least that's why I hope you practice. Levitation too would be nice, but I really hope that this is why we practice. To confirm over and over again that we belong. And by reflection, to confirm with each other that everyone belongs.